Paul's going to do a few brief things. Yeah.
Good morning, everyone. I'd like to call the Senate Committee on Healthcare and Veterans Affairs to order. It is February 24th, Tuesday, a rainy day, but a good day in Oregon, except for the economy. Now, I guess we have a quorum. Let's go ahead and take care of the bills that we need to pass out, the SJM. So I'd like to open a work session on SJM-1. Senator Morris,
yes,
that?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Or wait, I should have the administrator remind us what this bill is.
These are three SJMs. One is urges Congress to allow Oregon veterans to obtain state home loans at any time after a veteran separates from service. Do I want to take these one at a time?
Yeah.
Okay.
Any discussion?
Madam Chair,
yes.
I move that we pass SJM-1 to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation.
I think adopt. Senator Morissette has moved that we adopt SJM-1 and move it to the floor. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered. I'd like to open a work session on close a work session on SJM-1 and open a work session on SJM-2.
Madam Chair, the SJM-2 urges Congress to enact legislation creating a statewide transportation system to provide transportation for Oregon veterans, particularly disabled veterans, to and from medical facilities.
And as you see, we've received no revenue impact, and I don't see a fiscal impact. Do we need
They're all in. They should be in there. We do have fiscal and revenues for all.
Yeah, I don't have a fiscal in my
I don't.
But if you
I do have them.
If you have it.
Yeah.
Revenue and fiscal. Okay. All right.
Okay.
All right.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Move that we adopt SJM-2.
Senator Morissette moves that we adopt SJM-2. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered. And Senator Morissette, do you want to carry SJM-2? And then I forgot to say SJM-1. Senator Morris, would you carry SJM-1?
Certainly.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. Did we pass SJM-2?
3 we need.
We're into a work session on 3.
Okay. I'll close the work session on SJM-2 and open a work session on SJM-3.
Madam Chair, SJM-3 urges Congress to enact legislation providing complete health care for all honorary discharged veterans and their dependents.
Madam Chair, I move that we adopt SJM-3 and send it to the floor of the Senate with the do-pass and adoption.
All right. Senator Morissette moves that we adopt SJM-3 and move it to the floor with a do-pass adoption. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered. And please have the record show that Senator Bates and Senator Cruz are excused this morning.
Who's going to carry SJM?
And SJM-3 will have Senator Cruz carry it. With that, we'll close the work session on SJM-3. And let's open a public hearing on Senate Bill 455. Could I have the witness registration? And Mr. Shook.
Madam Chair, just to summarize, we have 7 bills that were assigned to this committee. From the recommendations from the Oregon Health Fund Board report. You heard the first bill last week, Senate Bill 451, which was the end-of-life registry. We have 2 bills today. We'll have 2 on next Tuesday, and we have the other 2 on the 10th. So the next 3 Tuesdays, we'll finish up with the Oregon Health Fund Board recommendations. We have 2 this morning. First one is Senate Bill 455. Requires the Office of Oregon Health Policy and Research to coordinate the work of the Health Resources Commission in the conduct of comparative effectiveness research and to coordinate the work of the Health Services Commission on the development of evidence-based health care guidelines.
All right. Dr. Smith and Mr. Baumeister, Doctor?
Dr. Baumeister.
Dr. Matt Baumeister and
good morning, Chairman Sanderson and members of the committee. I am Diane Lovell with Oregon AFSCME, and I'm pleased to testify today on Senate Bill 455, which can expand the use of common evidence-based clinical guidelines and best practice standards for the use of medical technology in Oregon, Oregon's healthcare system. Oregon has been a leader in using the best evidence in making purchasing decisions. I served on the Oregon Health Resources Commission when it started its groundbreaking work on reviewing the evidence on prescription drugs for the Oregon Health Plan, and now has over 20 states working together to continue regularly updating the evidence reviews for the state's purchasing of prescription drugs. I returned recently to serve on the commission as it expands that role to look at the comparative effectiveness of new and emerging medical technologies and treatments, such as its recent review of bariatric surgery, which led to the creation of an evidence-based bariatric surgery guideline within the Oregon Health Plan. I also serve on the Public Employee Benefits Board, PEB, where I recently served as the board's chair for several years as we implemented the board's vision. A key component of that vision is an innovative delivery system in communities statewide that uses evidence-based medicine to maximize health and utilize dollars wisely. The Health Fund Board envisions a high-performance healthcare delivery system as necessary to improve the health of all Oregonians. I participated in the Oregon Health Fund Board process by serving on the delivery committee from which the concept for Senate Bill 455 arose and was endorsed wholeheartedly by both the committee and the full Health Fund Board. A clinical improvement program, as outlined in Senate Bill 455, is an example of a system innovation that better coordinates healthcare treatments in a clinical setting with the best evidence available. By having multiple payers agree to a common set of guidelines and effective medical technology they will pay for, it assists providers to provide the level of care that has been shown to be the most effective to improve health. Involved in the purchasing of health care, both through AFSCME and my work on PEB, I see this initiative as a means to ensure that what is purchased for employees can get them the right care at the right time. Having common guidelines and best practice standards for the use of medical technology in their hands as they deliver care makes it easier for the healthcare providers to focus on the needs of their patients while using the best available information. Additionally, it ensures to me as a purchaser that we will be paying for the most effective care through publicly contracted plans in PEB and OEB and reduce unnecessary or ineffective treatments and their associated costs. This initiative allows the state to play a lead role in encouraging the private sector to work collaboratively with the public sector in this critical area of obtaining, reviewing, and disseminating the best available information for clinical decision-making. Uniformly applying these guidelines across the public and private sectors should lead to reductions in variation of care, more appropriate use of health resources, and higher quality of care. Our state is fortunate in the groundbreaking work of the Health Resources and the Health Services Commissions, which work closely with Oregon's superb resources for evidence-based reviews at the OHSU's Evidence-Based Practice Center and the collaboration with other states through OHSU's Center for Evidence-Based Policy. They are all doing great work. Senate Bill 455's Clinical Improvement Program takes the next step to build on all of these structures to bring public and private stakeholders together to transform the healthcare system. This is an important first next step to improve Oregon's healthcare delivery system and to transition it so that it delivers patient-centered and value-driven care. It helps Oregon to use its healthcare dollars and resources wisely. So thank you for this opportunity to present this testimony. I would be happy to eventually answer any questions. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Frank Baumeister. And until December 31st, I was a practicing physician, a gastroenterologist in Portland since 1970. And I, at the risk of being redundant here, because we all come from the same place, I thought I'd give you a little bit of a historical perspective on this program and why I support this bill and why I hope to see the use of these two commissions, the Health Services Commission, the Health Resources Commission, receive a wider influence. I view this as a continuum of a mission in which I was involved as an original member of the Oregon Health Resources Commission way back in the early days of the Oregon Health Plan. I was appointed, as a matter of fact, by Governor Barbara Roberts and served on the Health Resources Commission as one of its original members. And I see this bill moving us toward building a public-private partnership that we had always aimed for in the Oregon Health Plan to develop common evidence-based clinical guidelines and best practice standards for the introduction and use of medical technology in Oregon's healthcare system. Now, Oregon has long been an innovative national leader in the use of comprehensive objective reviews of the medical literature to compare effectiveness in health services. And as I stated, I served on the Oregon Health Resource Commission for 16 years as its chairman from 1992 to 2004, participating in its groundbreaking work as initially a technology assessment program and later evolving into its role in developing the practitioner-managed prescription drug program with its evidence-based reference drug-based formulary that's now employed by Oregon's Office of Medical Assistance Program. That program has now been extended. It's been adopted by a number of states. At last count, I think it was 13 or 14 states in evaluating their own drug programs. And it has received wide recognition. Recall that the original Oregon Health Plan envisioned universal health care with a public-private coverage, including Medicaid and employer obligation, and a high-risk pool for otherwise uninsurables. And now you hear the Oregon Health Fund Board asking in their first statement to, quote, get everyone under the tent, end quote, which goes back to that original goal of universal health care. The Health Services Commission was established to develop the list of included health services in the proposed benefit package, and the Health Resources Commission was initially established to address anticipated cost increases incident to increasing health care coverage. We investigated all the major cost drivers of health care, including an increasing and aging population, increasing expectations and demands, end-of-life care, defensive medicine due to litigation fear, and introduction and dissemination of new technology. And of those elements, new and emerging technologies ranked number one and were in need of more rational and objective assessment. The HRC developed a technology assessment program which brought together panels of diverse representation to study and evaluate recommended and selected technologies. These panels included physicians, and those included academic and community-based, specialists and generalists, rural and urban, in addition to nurses, hospital administrators, manufacturers, representatives, and laypersons, to meet and review literature and data and report their recommendations to the Health Resources Commission. The HRC studied those reports and then issued their recommendations. There was resistance, sometimes significant, to our efforts, from Health Industry Manufacturers Association, from pharma, from some advocacy representatives, but none could criticize the scholarship, objectivity, and legitimacy of the reports. Recommendations were implemented by OMAP and also incorporated into a number of private insurer protocols, but there was not widespread adoption outside of OMAP. When rising pharmaceutical costs of the Oregon Health Plan were threatening to break the OMAP bank, rising over 60% in one biennium, and exceeding total physician and hospital costs, OMAP called upon the HRC to adapt its by now matured technology assessment program to the study of multiple drug classes. The HRC contracted with the Evidence-Based Practice Center at OHSU, one of, at that time, I think, a dozen evidence-based practice centers across the country, to provide literature reviews and statistical analysis of published drug trials. Within a class of drugs, a, quote, reference drug was identified that was as effective and safe as any drug in that class, but was at the lowest price of those equally effective. This became the reference drug, and all effective drugs within 105% of the cost of that drug would then be included in a formulary. This reference-based formulary was authorized in 2001, and since then, substantial savings without loss of drug efficacy have been demonstrated over and over with multiple drug classes. Our experience with statins, those cholesterol-lowering drugs, has been exemplary. Despite objections by pharmaceutical industry representatives touting their more expensive brands, HRC studies conclusively demonstrated less costly drugs to be equally effective and safe, saving Oregon millions of dollars in that drug class alone. Samuel Taylor Coleridge described prose as words in their best order, while poetry was described as the best words in their best order. With pharmaceuticals and healthcare technology, we need a more poetic approach. Currently, drugs and technology are often introduced, marketed, and disseminated without having been thoroughly evaluated or vetted. Are they more effective than those currently available? Will their introduction lead to better outcomes or fewer side effects or fewer complications? Is their cost worth it? Is this simply a me-too drug capitalizing on the success of an earlier, now less expensive, possibly generic model that has lost its patent? Or is this a real breakthrough drug or technology worthy of widespread adoption and use? Delay in implementation is as unacceptable as is too hasty acceptance. Are racial and cultural disparities addressed in such assessments and recommendations? Are specific populations represented in decisions regarding treatments? Balance between these extremes and healthcare innovation can be achieved only by objective and transparent assessment and reporting. As we move in the near future toward universal adoption of electronic medical records, these common guidelines can easily be linked to provide providers with electronic access to the best treatment options at the critical delivery point when they are with the patient. The Health Fund Board envisions a high-performance healthcare delivery system is necessary to improve the health of all Oregonians, bringing everyone under the tent. I served as chairman of the Federal Laws Committee, which studied and reported to the Health Fund Board on those federal laws which might impact Oregon's health reform efforts. A major national health care reform effort's now on the near horizon, and at the national level, comparative effectiveness of drugs and technology is receiving renewed attention as new and emerging medical technology continues to drive health care costs ever higher. Nevertheless, healthcare, like politics, is local, and a coordinated effort at the state level to provide our providers with the best evidence is more necessary now than ever. Systematic, objective medical literature reviews are the foundation of evidence-based practice. Such reviews performed by the Evidence-Based Practice Center at OHSU for the Health Resources Commission have already proven their worth many times over in drug evaluations. Technology assessments have been more fragmented and less organized. Collaboration in the development and dissemination of evidence-based guidelines and recommendations among the multiple private and public payers and providers is the next logical and practical step. Senate Bill 455 now unites the public and private sectors of healthcare delivery in this joint assessment effort, as I had always hoped they would be. Again, I thank you for giving me the opportunity to come before you today.
Thank you very much. And thank you for all that you've done for healthcare.
Thank you.
Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee, I'm Janine Smith, the administrator for the Office of Health Policy and Research. And you'll note in your packet there's a fact sheet that has some detailed analysis about this bill. I wanted just to touch on a few details. As it is noted before, it's a series of the recommendations coming out of the Oregon Health Fund Board, which our office staffed. And it's one of the next best steps to improve the health care delivery system in Oregon by reducing costs and improving access and quality. This work sets the stage to help bend the curve of health care costs in Oregon as the rapid explosion of medical technology is the leading cause of rising health care costs. It brings together the state, health care insurers, and providers together to develop and implement a common evidence-based clinical guidelines and best practice standards for the use of medical technology. As you've already heard, Oregon has been a leader in this area, and this bill builds on the current existing structures and statutes of the Health Services Commission and the Health Resources Commission to coordinate efforts with the private sector on the evidence of health services. The state would play a convening role to develop this common set of evidence-based guidelines and best practice clinical standards. By generating information and incorporating this into how plans pay and how the benefit design is structured, it could result in significant health system savings. Uniformly applying the best evidence across public and private sector should lead to reductions in the variation of care, more appropriate use of health resources, and higher quality of care. The concept as it was developed by the board was that this would initially have a strong focus on chronic conditions and will review and endorse already existing high-quality guidelines if they're already there, as well as ability to convene experts, as has been done in the past, to create them when they don't exist. The work of the commissions would be closely aligned with overall healthcare outcomes and the goals as determined by if there was a health authority entity created, so that we're all in alignment across what are the most focused areas to direct their efforts at. This initiative builds on existing state functions and is actually very similar to what is done in Minnesota and has been done for the last 20 years through the Institute for Clinical Systems Improvement, or ICSI. The ICSI brings together diverse groups to transform their healthcare system so that they have a common set of agreed clinical guidelines and how to use medical technology. They have worked with over 50 medical groups in that state and over 6 of their major largest insurers. I mean, I remember back in my old practice days that was a resource to actually work through some guidelines, because it was unclear really how many different places as a physician that you have to look to find a particular set of guidelines. So there is a lot of wide variation in how care is delivered. If you look at the most recent work from the Dartmouth folks who do the Dartmouth Atlas, and where they take Medicare costs and look at how we're using them across the country, they noted in their recent 2008 report that the Mayo Clinic was cited to use fewer resources and spend less per capita than their peers, equally other high-quality health centers, while still receiving extremely high marks on established quality measures. Other centers of care can spend far more resources and have no better quality of care. Working with private purchasers, health plans, and providers in the development of this common clinical guidelines and use of medical technology, these common policies could be developed across multiple payers, particularly in the publicly funded programs such as PEB and OEB, where we direct and contract with the private sector plans. Based on the work of the Commonwealth Fund 2008 report, Bending the Curve, the estimates of potential savings in Oregon if there was widespread use of evidence-based common clinical guidelines and medical technology assessments could be up to $650 million in 3 years and up to $4.2 billion in 10 years. Currently, the HRC and the HSC do great work and partner with other states to keep the costs of the detailed evidence-based literature reviews down by sharing costs across the multiple states. However, as thinly staffed volunteer commissions, there is a constraint on their ability to expand this coordination across the private plans. There is state funding of about $420,000 included in the governor's recommended budget that would provide the additional resources to facilitate this collaboration consideration with the public and private health plans for both the comparative effectiveness and evidence-based guidelines, and would include a small amount of consulting or other comparative effectiveness analytical tools to help the commissions. And at that point, I'll close and open it up for any questions you might have of myself or the panel.
With the the Health Resources Commission, do they already have a database, and would this be building on a database that they have, or is this going to be entirely different from what our formulary, drug formulary is based on?
Senator Moon Sanderson and members of the committee, the Health Resources Commission has worked on a series of reviews, of which there's a large group of pharmaceutical drug class reviews that they're constantly updating in partnership with about 15 other states. They get an evidence-based review that all 15 states purchase collectively, and it goes back to each of the states to then digest and make recommendations to their particular plan. The Health Services Commission is constantly updating the list and does guidelines on various portions of the list. What this bill does is have these two commissions work with Regents, Providence, other health plans, and look and see where is their commonality between everyone has some clinical guidelines that will pay for a hysterectomy if these things have been done before you go. And so as a doc in a clinic, you know, you have to think, oh, this is a Medicaid patient. Oh, what's my rules and regs about getting this paid for here versus Regents versus Providence versus... So by having us all sit around the table, which is what they've done in Minnesota for the last 20 years, they come up with sort of some common guidelines. And by having the Health Resources and Services Commission involved, you're getting the detailed evidence-based literature reviews as sort of your basis, so that it's not, and it's done in a public process, so that you're not influenced one way or the other, but you're getting just unbiased information to make that common decision as a group with the public and private payers.
Can you give an example of, put it in real terms, regarding a particular service?
I would say, Dr. Baumeister and I were talking last evening, that one of the classic ways that this has been beneficial is that initially with breast cancer, there were bone marrow transplants were considered the ultimate in treatment for this. In the past, evidence-based reviews looked at this and found really no evidence for this being really truly effective, yet multiple plans across the state, across the country, were paying for this, and it was determined by that Medicaid would not. But if you also, you know, if the public employees also weren't getting treatment access to something that wasn't proven to be effective, and other plans all follow suit to use the same set of non-biased information to make their determination, perhaps we would have saved a lot. One, we would have saved a great deal of money, but more importantly, we wouldn't have maybe put patients through a procedure that was ultimately proven to not be as effective as it had been originally touted when it first came out.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Morissette.
In the bill, section 1-4, page 18-19, Public Employees Benefits Board, Oregon Public Employees Board, Department of Corrections, and Department of Human Services shall vigorously pursue. What does that mean? Is OPDP, Oregon Prescription Drug Program, included in this?
Senator Morissette and Chair Mona Sanderson and other members of the committee, I think that the essence of the under Section 1, subsection 4, is that the public employees or other public purchasers look to contract for healthcare services, they would want to make sure that the services being provided to their clients or employees would ensure that the same common guidelines and use of technology was all the same. If they chose currently OEB, the Oregon Educators Board, contracts with ODS, which uses the Oregon Prescription Drug Program. So if there was a common set of, ideally, I guess, if we wanted to set some common standards around what drugs should or shouldn't be used, the OPDP program does mirror as much as it can to its individual discount card members the same drugs that the Health Resources Commission has reviewed and tries to recommend generics and the most effective drugs information. The group OEB could choose to make sure that that was included in their purchasing arrangements with the ODS companies. Diane.
Chairman Anderson and members of the committee. Likewise, PEB has been looking at evidence-based care for a number of years, as you know, Senator Morissette. So, for example, in the areas of imaging, lab work, we believe that there is a lot of money to be saved and health improvements to be made, but we really believe that we need to create some synergy so that a variety of health plans offering this care approach these kinds of tests similarly. So this would be very consistent with PEB's vision that we've been working on now for a number of years.
Okay. I guess my question is on the pharmaceutical end of it, and I noticed corrections is included, and currently the corrections, I believe you mentioned Minnesota. Is there a Minnesota consortium that is a bulk purchasing group that we belong to?
Senator Morissette, Chair Bonus Anderson, I believe the corrections is part of a multi-state purchasing of what drugs they purchase, and corrections is part of that. What I was mentioning in Minnesota was more of a effort amongst the various health plans and healthcare providers in Minnesota to try to use the sort of the same practice guidelines as they choose to order a test or choose to write a prescription.
Okay. Well, I'm asking is, are you going to create a single formulary for as many for the state of Oregon for all of the components that provide pharmaceuticals? Single formulary.
Chairman Sanders, Senator Morissette, this bill does not directly address that. It certainly is something that others could consider, but I think the essence is trying to come together to common voluntary use of the same set of guidelines. And if that includes pharmaceutical drugs, then perhaps that's something the state might want to consider.
Okay. Can I follow up, please? Mm-hmm. The formulary would, as you described, the purchasing aspect of it, looking at drugs within classes of drugs, the best ones, and getting the best price for that particular product would save money. And the larger the pool would help to save that money. So it sounds like there is an effort to zero in on the most effective drug within each class of drugs and to include that in a formulary as broadly as possible.
Chairman Sanderson, Senator Morissette, that's certainly some of the look of what the Health Resources work has been to date with the Medicaid program. I think the essence of this has been more focused kind of more globally about, you know, should I order this test or that test as my next step of treatment, and should I be ordering that really expensive gamma knife treatment for this, or is there a better treatment or a older treatment that has just as much effectiveness? It's, this bill overall is not targeted specifically to pharmaceutical drugs. It's probably across all services, and there's probably, once some common agreement was made on certain areas, it's, you know, then it would be under further discussion as to whether you went to the more focused attention to that.
I see. Thank you. It's, yeah, the language is rather broad, but yet I see aspects of it that raise some interest.
So who will have access to this database?
Chair Monis Anderson, it isn't that we're necessarily creating a database. We would be creating sort of some common guidelines that could then be publicly put together. What Minnesota has is a website you can go to, and you can see all the clinical guidelines. So you type in diabetes, and this whole long, you know, if this, then this, then this, then this is available. So getting this disseminated out to providers is equally very important. And if they're, you know, if I'm a physician in practice with 15 different health plans that I see patients from, and I know there's one guideline I can kind of look at when I'm kind of wondering what my next step is with a patient, then I would have one place to go, and that would be part of the thinking, is getting common agreement and then figuring out how to disseminate it back to the providers and all the plans working together on that, be it DMAP or private plans.
And what kind of response are you getting from the medical providers? Are they seeking this type of... I mean, knowing some physicians are very independent and autonomous and don't want people to tell them what would be the best...
I was quoted some years ago in saying that most physicians had more brand loyalty to their shampoo than they did to their drugs of choice. And I think that still holds in terms of the statins, in terms of the proton pump inhibitors, in terms of antibiotic use, in terms of cardiac drugs. From the experience in the practitioner-managed prescription drug program, in which panels were assembled from diverse origin all over the state, the enthusiasm with which the physicians joined in this program was amazing.
Okay.
They were very glad to see it. They know that drugs are marketed like other products, and the resistance from the manufacturers, from the drug representatives, was expected, but the objectivity won out, and the medical profession accepted it. At the time that we were undergoing a lot of these changes, I was president of the Oregon Medical Association. This was roundly debated at the House of Delegates and was strongly supported.
Senator Cruz, I keep hearing him sighing here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm trying to figure out why this bill is necessary. I guess I think these entities could do this now, couldn't you?
Chairman Sanderson, Senator Cruz, the statutes for the two commissions don't preclude us from doing it now. I think what the health fund board, when they directed this, was that it was giving direction to the other public agencies such as PEB and OEB to really take these and use them and use and collaborate together so that we were all commonly doing it, similar to a uniformity in terms of their purchasing power to really help drive it. That we've been doing it just in the Medicaid agency now for about 15 years, but it hasn't really filtered out into the other private sector. And if you think about a physician's practice or anyone's practice, that it isn't just Medicaid patients they're seeing multiple. So if they're bombarded by multiple different things from different plans, that if we could get them all voluntarily to get together, it would drive that. And so it's more of a directive that the legislature would be giving them to make sure you go forth and do this. And from both the HRC and HSC could certainly do it on their own, but whether the other entities would choose to participate and drive it through their contracting processes, this would give some direction to say to those of both Diane and I sit on the PEB board, this is something we really want to have happen.
Your follow-up?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
PEB and OEB shall vigorously pursue, if they're doing due diligence, they're already doing that. that is their charge, is to find the best and the most cost-effective. That is their charge. And so we have to put in statute to tell them to do what they already should be doing?
Chairman Anderson and Representative, I'm sorry, Senator Cruz, I think that's very appropriate for you to mention. I sit on the PEB board, and we do attempt to vigorously pursue this, but we are lay persons, and we don't necessarily have the expertise that to decide on any particular treatment what is the best evidence. And so we look to some convening organizations that are charged with being experts to let us know what those are, so then we then can make sure that we are contracting for those appropriate services. It would be much more effective if the various healthcare organizations that we contract with, that OIV contracts with, could come to an agreement along with the state on what those best practices were, so that we could be assured that those were permeated throughout all of the various insurance companies in Oregon, so we would be able to assure ourselves that we're contracting for those best practices.
Well, Madam Chair, this has become circular now, and I'm just looking at this bill and reading the statute on the charges of all these entities, and this is what they should be doing now. I'm just curious as to why we need legislation to make this happen.
Senator Morris.
Thank you. I'd like to tailgate on Senator Cruz. In reading the bill, essentially it says shall research, shall disseminate, and with respect to the public health plans, shall vigorously pursue, and then with respect to the other plans, encourage to adopt. Those are the words. And I'm trying to make the next leap to how do we in fact bend the cost curve when all of this is advisory. What would be problematic with on line 19 substituting shall vigorously pursue to shall adopt? If the findings have efficacy, they're clinically based, they're sound, why wouldn't we require those public health plans to adopt the findings? And then the other question I have for Dr. Baumeister is your reference to the defensive medicine due to litigation fear and the emerging technologies. It seems to me that those two issues are linked. And how would this bill affect the defensive practice of medicine when on the one hand we might be prescribing specific procedures, on the other hand you're still open to physicians are still open to the risk of loss by virtue of not utilizing possibly new technology?
Well, it's a fine line, a catch-22, but I think that guidelines do offer protection against litigation if the guidelines are followed. And the issue all along has been this balancing act between voluntary compliance and more regulation, whether it's a voluntary formulary or whether it's a restrictive formulary. And I've gotten older and engaged in these wars longer and longer, I've leaned more toward a more stringent requirement, whether it's a formulary, because in the past the education regarding drugs in a physician's office was administered by a drug salesman, and it was not unusual to see a succession of patients in your office who were on a drug regimen, a number of drugs, whether for hypertension or whether for heart failure or for chronic ulcer disease or what have you. And you would see a succession of patients come in, and not one of those patients was on the same drug regimen as the other. They were all on the drug du jour. And the variation in the price of those drugs was dramatic. And that still is the case. And and it's also in the case of choices of therapy. It's been shown, you know, there was a study that showed that applying objective guidelines in reviewing the encounter between a physician and a patient, that appropriate care was administered in that encounter approximately 53% of the time. So there is a lot of variation. There's a variation in end-of-life care. There's a variation in managing simple problems. You've heard reference this morning to the Dartmouth Atlas, and Dr. Winberg, who's been writing on this for years, the variation in health care and health care costs without any significant change in quality is astronomical. The Medicare recipient in Dade County, Florida, $10,000 to $12,000 a year. Portland, Oregon, $3,500 a year. Is the care better in Dade County? No, it's not. So somewhere along the line, we have to, the healthcare right now is a mess. It's a mess financially, and it's in turmoil. And we need some guidelines. And whether it's in the formulary, or whether it's in choice of diagnostic equipment, or whether it's in the approach, the basic doctor-patient relationship in a single patient encounter, there have to be some better guidelines. Everybody is hitching their wagon to the star of the electronic medical record, and that may bring some order out of chaos, and it may not. It's going to be an expensive proposition, but we all need guidelines. They needed guidelines in the economic system, in the financial system. We need some guidelines in the healthcare arena as well.
Madam Chair, yes. I still, and I appreciate your comments, and I don't take exception to any of it. But I fail to see how this bill really drives to that cost issue, because it's just advisory. Disseminate, encourage. I just question how much effect it will have at the end of the day.
Just a follow-up on that. In my reasoning, it may not be correct, but I look at guidelines, at least in when I'm practicing nursing, I follow these guidelines, and they're usually orders from doctors, but they make my... that gives me... if I'm following the guidelines, then it's on someone else's back if something goes wrong, in a sense. So if this is evidence-based, it means that those guidelines are in the best interest of the patient, best interest of the doctor, best interest in whatever. So, to me, I think it's a beginning step in tort reform. A step. You're right. It's voluntary, but until we get some data to prove that this is really working and actually saving the healthcare system a lot of money, I just envision it as an appropriate step.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Evidence-based is a good thing, except, and I'm not a doctor, so I don't know, but I would suggest that I could have a condition that could be successfully treated in one way, where Senator Morse could have the same condition that would need to be treated in a different way because we're different humans. But be that as it may, I guess what I would like to know is what is happening here on the national level, and how does this fit in with that? I would hate to see us doing 50 state things if there's a more universal approach being taken.
Chairman Sanderson, Senator Cruz, in the stimulus package, there is some significant dollars put in to try to coordinate this on a national level and put more money towards more evidence-based reviews. The Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality has been doing some evidence-based reviews. In fact, we've used those, such as the one for bariatric surgery, which is the treatment for obesity, and other guidelines along different, you know, hypertensive drugs. Should we start with this drug or this drug or this drug? So there's some great stuff coming out of the federal level, but now there's a renewed interest because of it, noting that this is where healthcare costs are increasing. And so the more we can lower the amount of variation in care to the most effective treatment, so people aren't spending dollars or putting patients through things that ultimately don't help, but and using those dollars more to get the care they need. There are some procedures that will be more expensive and will be more effective, and we want to invest in those. And there's certain patients where maybe this particular treatment isn't the one that they should have, but at least the physician could start with kind of the what the guidelines suggest, and then see how that patient responds, knowing that there's uniqueness to individual patients. When the Health Resources Commission looks at any of this huge massive amount of literature that's collected for them to digest, they look at, you know, certain subpopulations that may need a slightly different adjustment to that care, because we know that one size does not fit all patients. But if you're going to start somewhere and you have a brand new hypertensive patient and you want to start maybe with the most evidence-based first drug and see how that patient does, right, and then tailor it from there on, that's rather than starting with the most expensive drug that the sales rep came in and sold you that day as being the best thing.
You suggest such a thing.
Not that we would ever do that.
Shocked.
But not the, you know, but you hear something about this drug, well, it's supposed to be good, but you don't know what that something is. My office has been doing a little bit of this by trying to get some evidence-based data out to providers. We had a small grant through some money we got from the Department of Justice in relationship to some perhaps mismarketing of a drug. And so we used that to come up with sort of a curriculum about evidence-based drugs, evidence-based reviews of information, and we're targeting it to providers. We've gone around and done it to doctors' groups at various hospitals around the state. You know, to help guide them to know what is the best evidence to make those clinical decisions. So, more tools we can give to providers. They have the power of the pen, as is often said, and a lot of those healthcare costs are coming from the other end of that pen. And so, giving them tools to have, and the more common collected wisdom together, so that they're not getting multiple messages from multiple different sides, is sort of the essence of this.
Following up a little bit on what he was saying, I believe you had stated there might be some amendments coming to this bill that would address the cultural disparities that we need to address. Could you make a comment on that?
Senator Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, Oregon Health Fund Board had a special committee focused on health inequities, and they were called the health equities, trying to improve them. And so there was a series where we've looked at all our bills. Some of them had specific language, and some we would like to accentuate that language to ensure that it is that all these efforts of these seven bills are directed to be sure that minorities and people of color it's thoughtful planning to include perhaps any adjustments or increase efforts to make sure that the health inequities are ensured. And we'll be providing those to the committee administrator very soon.
Yeah. Can you give us some information on the federal efforts? I think that would be helpful in informing what we do at this level as well.
And then also let us know if there are stimulus monies that could help fund projects like this. Maybe not.
Yeah, Senator Mosa Anderson and Senator Cruz, I think most of the dollars are directed towards getting more money done for doing these very expensive reviews. I mean, if we did all of our reviews and paid for them ourselves, it runs into hundreds of thousands of dollars per review. So by doing them collectively with other states, and if federal dollars are going in there, then we have things that could actually be more and more medical technology can be reviewed that otherwise would be very prohibitive for individual states to do. So I think what you'll see from the federal stimulus is that it's actually an influx to make this be even more useful, because we'll be getting more information and more evidence for the collaborative effort to use.
So have we been making outreach to other states? Or would
Senator Moss Anderson, we currently are part of two collaboratives. One around pharmaceutical drugs,
right.
It's called the DERP, the Drug Effectiveness Review, and that's about 15 to 20 states and one of the provinces in Canada, and that's the one that they sort of modeled after Oregon originally and worked through the Center for Evidence-Based Policy at OHSU, and then the Practice Center does the actual exhaustive literature reviews. We also are part of a thing called the MEDS Project, which is done around medical technology. We use them to complete our recently completed autism study, because multiple other states wanted to kind of know what was the state of evidence around treatment for autism. It's the same with bariatric surgery. And so we put in with other states what kind of were our hot topics we really want to focus on, and collectively all the states decide which reviews are going to come out for that particular year. Again, as more money comes federally, that'll make it more availability of those kind of reports.
Yes, Senator Morse.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to come back to this advisory versus let's do it. I would maybe respond to if this bill was amended to shall adopt.
Chair Monith Anderson and members of the committee, Senator Morris, I think that PEB would be happy to adopt. I think the issue is getting the various health plans at the table so they feel good about these practice guidelines. I think that PEB would love to have something to adopt. We have adopted the drug recommendations by the Health Resources Commission. We've saved a lot of money for the state. So I think it's really a matter of having something available and out there where there is widespread agreement among the various health plans and all the physicians that practice within those health plans. I don't think the issue is will we do it. It is there a product, if you will, that we can rely on the health plans to be able to provide, that we can contract for?
I'm surprised that the payers haven't signed up on this bill or plans. When you testified on this on the other side, were they at the table? Or have you testified?
Senator Moniz Anderson, this bill did not get a hearing yet on the House side.
Okay. We're talking about it. So payers out there, health plans out there, sounds good. There's no opposition. Just going to go forward. All right. Is there any further discussion on this? All right. All right. Will you work with the administrator in getting those amendments through? We will come back and discuss this. Any further comments from anybody? All right. Is there anyone? Yeah.
I keep pushing this issue.
Yeah.
Because I want this to be meaningful. We all want it to be meaningful. We all want it to make a difference in bending this cost curve. Would you entertain an amendment for consideration that changes the character of these recommendations?
Then we might get the payers and the
and I suspect
at the table.
Get the payers. And in
mm-hmm.
fact, the amendment might include a process to move this forward with the third-party payers to the conclusion of an adoption agenda rather than just advisory.
Could you submit that as a separate amendment also, and so that we can have the discussion?
Senator Monsanto, we can certainly create some draft language and
yeah.
for your consideration.
Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I would certainly like to see those amendments. I would put a word of caution out. This is a complex issue. Looking at patients with comorbidity, it's difficult. You need clear lines of what are best practices. You know, most of us get our information from the journals. I happen to use Journal Watch because it kind of compiles this stuff. On the other hand, the variation in healthcare across the state and various communities is huge, and there's no logical reason for it. And it's expensive, and it doesn't serve patients well. And in the midst of all this, we're talking about putting together a health authority that would really start looking at these issues in a way that's more, I think, practical, more thoughtful than we can do here in a committee. So while I might well support the amendments, I would tell you a little caution here is important. This is the beginning of a huge change in healthcare delivery, and I fully support this bill. But it's going to be folded into, hopefully, 2009, which will be a bill which will bring us a health authority in the state, which will set up committees that will really look at this stuff and ask some pretty tough questions of physicians and nurse practitioners and other providers and hospitals of, why are you doing this at your area? Well, area B is doing something entirely different. Why are your patients so much different than B? And you're going to find the answers are that, well, we've just always done it that way. It's time to change and get down to evidence-based care. But this is pretty touchy stuff, and I'm sure the good doctor understands what I'm talking about here, if he wishes to comment.
Well, I certainly agree. I mean, it's as I said before, but I also agree that this lukewarm approach and this sort of pussyfooting around it has been dragging on for a long time.
Yep, it has.
And, you know, my career is winding down, you know, and I've been at this since I was a boy. And as I said in my opening comments, I see this as hopefully a completion of a mission that we started 20 years ago. And it works. You know, the practitioner managed prescription drug program works. It saves money. It doesn't impact quality negatively. It was embraced by the medical profession. Some representatives of the pharmaceutical industry, physicians that were on the dole from pharmaceutical industries, were our loudest, most vocal opponents. But we overcame that, and it works. It was unreasonable that drug costs for the Oregon Health Plan outstripped both hospital and physician costs. Or that was hard to believe, but that was the way it was. With the statins alone, we saved millions of dollars. We did exhaustive reviews, demonstrated that less expensive drugs were as good as the more expensive drug. Guidelines have been with us forever. You know, we learned guidelines in medical school. We honed those guidelines in our postgraduate training. We further developed those guidelines in our heads as we practiced and gained experience. And we attended conferences and grand rounds and discussions with other physicians. It was always developing guidelines. But something has gone amiss, as evidenced by the incredible variation in health care, the incredible volume of the medical canon or database that's out there now. It's overwhelming for individual physicians. And some coordination seems to be the next step. And like I say, the electronic medical record will help this a lot. But it's that's down the road. And I agree. When I read the bill, it has a lukewarm approach. We have adopted this voluntary make suggestions and hope they'll be followed approach for a long time. And we've had enough experience to know that this works if it could be incorporated. My hope is that it can be.
All right. You have your orders. We will definitely be continuing this conversation, and thank you very much. You can stay there if you're still going to be... No?
Senator Mo Sanderson, I don't think Dr. Moorhead is here yet, but we're... to join me for
okay.
the second bill.
All right. Is there anyone else who would want to testify on Senate Bill 455? With that, I would like to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 455, and I would like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 457. And would you come and let us at least start the conversation? And okay, and we can at least have part of it if Dr. Moorhead.
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 457. Again, another bill driven by the recommendations of the Oregon Health Fund Board requires the Office of Health Policy and Research to create a healthcare workforce database using information from health professions licensing process and the Oregon's healthcare regulatory boards.
All right. Dr. Smith.
Senator Mona Sanderson and members of the committee, I'm, for the record again, still Janine Smith, Administrator for the Office of Health Policy and Research, and this I wanted to review some of the details about Senate Bill 457, which is the Healthcare Workforce Initiative and Data Collection. I'm joined up here today with Graham Slater from the Oregon Employment Department as well, and then we'll be hopefully awaiting Dr. John Moorhead from OHSU before the morning is over. So again, this is another one of the series of bills resulting from the Oregon Health Fund Board's recommendations to the governor and the legislature. It's focused again as a next best step towards system transformation of our healthcare delivery system. As the healthcare workforce has been an important component of the discussions of both the board and its delivery system work group since Oregon faces significant healthcare workforce shortages as our population need increases. And certainly the board looked at this as an important aspect as they look towards more comprehensive health reform. There was what Senate Bill 457 does is it implements a data collection program using the health profession's licensing processes and provides routine data analysis so Oregon has an ongoing capacity to, understand Oregon's healthcare workforce, two, inform the public and private education about educational and workforce investments needed to maintain and sustain that workforce, and three, inform policy recommendations for state health planning regarding Oregon's health workforce. This bill was developed in a collaborative effort and was very similar to Senator Morris's efforts, and it actually is very similar bill language and almost a mirror image of Senate Bill 11 that Senator Morris introduced. The effort was led by Joe Igskrig of the Oregon Healthcare Workforce Initiative, who could not be here today as she is in Klamath Falls on business with the Workforce Institute, and sends her regrets. But she helped to convene the members of the staffs of the various licensing boards to try to think this concept through, and worked very closely with Senator Morris's interim committee on health reform to get this concept put together. Dr. Moorhead and myself had worked closely through the Oregon Medical Association with Senator Wyden about sort of similar concepts for his federal bill around health care, and wanting to add some amendments which included these similar concepts of the need to get a really good handle on our health care workforce through better data collection. So under this bill, the proposed health authority would oversee the overall implementation, and the expectation as outlined in this, in Senate Bill 457, is that the Office of Health Policy would partner with the nonprofit Oregon Workforce Institute to work with the licensing boards to develop, implement, and maintain the data and its analysis, and trying to streamline that through the licensing process. And the aim is to not create a whole lot of extra effort or work for either the licensees or the boards, but still get very good, high-quality data, and we want to be sure that it's workable for all parts. My office has participated in physician workforce surveys with the Medicaid agency and with the Oregon Medical Association over the last several years, And we found that, one, there's some national sources for information, but it's not very complete, and it's much delayed. Our survey work, we don't get a really great response because you have busy practitioners. It's hard to get them to fill out a survey. That's sort of known nationally, that us, especially docs, are not really good at filling out surveys. And my office gives me a bad time all the time that I don't fill out surveys. But I'm sure Senator Bates does.
Can I be just excused for this morning? I mean, this is not going well for me this morning.
So by doing it as part of your natural licensing activity, where you have to fill out a whole lot of other information anyway, we could get a better picture of what exactly is are all our providers doing. There are some providers who work in four or five different locations. It's very hard to track down where they are practicing. My office tried to do a survey if there was a tsunami coming in and you wanted to know where the medical practices were that maybe would need to take care of a lot of folks if there was a huge flu epidemic or something like that. It was really hard to find a list of where everybody was, how much they practiced, where they were, in case there was a big surge or big need. We sat down with Senator Morse a couple of 3 years ago saying how nice it would be if we had a better picture. And then as we hear about federal dollars, and I'll have the Employment Division representative talk a little bit about a lot of workforce training dollars come in through a Labor and Employment Division, so on a federal level. And that's what we found out through our work with the Wyden Workforce Committee, and how do you get those dollars directed? So how can you say this is where we really need those dollars targeted? Because we don't really know what and who and how everyone exists. So as you will hear, the idea is to pursue this in collaboration with the Workforce Institute, and there is in the governor's recommended budget some dollars set aside for this that would require a state investment of about $474,000, and that was to facilitate the Workforce Institute working with the boards to try to get this data collected and analyzed in collaboration with my office. So on that,
different boards do different things. So I could get. I don't know if the Board of Nursing still does this, but I remember I had to fill out a survey before I could be reissued my license.
Yes, Senator Mose Anderson, that's true. Nursing is far ahead of the rest of us in doing this. They have great data collection. But that's not true in the case of other licensing boards.
Okay.
At this, I'll turn over to Dr. Moorhead. Thank you for coming.
Good morning. Good morning.
Good morning. Welcome.
Members of the committee. I'm Dr. John Moorhead. I'm an emergency physician from Portland. I'm here representing the Oregon Healthcare Workforce Institute. I'm president-elect of that organization, and we're here to express our strong support for 457. This committee, I think you have a copy of our briefing. I'm just going to give you some highlights, if I might. This committee, the Senate Subcommittee on Health, Health Fund Board, policymakers, healthcare practitioners, and health professionals and educators all recognize that an ongoing accurate data collection system reveals crucial workforce elements such as the number of active practitioners, clinical specialties, and geographic distribution is intrinsic to address Oregon's healthcare workforce shortage. We know the shortage exists, but we can't tell you exactly the scope of it. The present data on Oregon's healthcare workforce is too general, it's fragmented, it's inconsistent, and it's outdated. Thus, it's really not a good basis to make effective decisions on targeting public investments in health professions education and other related health education and workforce policies. Give you one example, just in terms of the physicians. In 2008, the Oregon Medical Board database showed 11,000 active licensed physicians. In 2006, Oregon Office of Health Policy and Research and the OMA survey identified 8,100 active licensed physicians in Oregon providing direct patient care. In 2006, the Oregon Employment Department identified 6,700 physicians in Oregon's workforce. The problem is pretty evident. The solution then is to pinpoint active healthcare workforce, and the logical venue is the health profession licensing process. Oregon has a successful model. You just related to it, Senator. Since 2001, the Oregon State Board of Nursing, in collaboration with the Oregon Center for Nursing, have collaborated on data collection via the licensing process. The analysis of that data shows the compelling case of a statewide nursing shortage and supports targeted public investments to increase educational capacity for nursing students. Many other states have already shown us the way. Many other states are already engaged in health workforce data collection, and they do this through the licensing process. So we have models. We have looked at them in other states. Following a request from the Senate Subcommittee on Healthcare Reform, in December of 2007, the Oregon Healthcare Workforce Institute convened the executive directors from 19 boards, health workforce and research experts, and other stakeholders over the course of a year to develop a work plan to collect accurate, consistent, uniform healthcare workforce data routinely via the health professions licensing process. The work plan, as reflected in Senate Bill 457, identifies essential workforce and workplace data collection questions, which will build off the current questions included in each board's application and will be tailored to fit the specifics of that occupation. The work group identified a phased-in data collection effort targeting key access and shortage occupations first. Physicians, physician's assistants, dentists, dental hygienists, pharmacists, pharmacy technicians, dietitians, occupational therapists and assistants, and physical therapists and assistants, and includes the current data collection effort with the nursing professions. The frequency and method of data collection, whether in a paper application or moving to an online format, are determined by the individual board's licensing renewal process. For several boards, the inclusion of workforce data questions coincides with the development of an online renewal application, allowing for some cost efficiencies. The key issues identified and addressed by the boards and other stakeholders include the following: focusing the data collection effort on essential questions to avoid undue costs and burden on licensees, protecting the confidentiality of licensees, requiring the completion of workforce questions as part of the application to provide an accurate picture of Oregon's active licensed healthcare workforce. The boards identified that there may be some additional costs, such as for reformatting paper applications, programming online application questions, data input from paper applications, and some follow-up process with licensees in order to ensure that they complete the questions. Similar to the efforts of the Board of Nursing and the Oregon Center for Nursing, following the license renewal period, the Oregon Healthcare Workforce Institute will work with licensing boards and the Oregon Office of Health Policy and Research for analysis and production of healthcare workforce reports using aggregated data. This health workforce data will afford a better picture of the specifics, such as retirement projections, geographic distribution and migration, diversity and retention, to inform educational program capacity expansion and evaluate healthcare workforce policies as well, to help Oregon prepare for and respond to emergency and disaster situations. We understand there are some suggested amendments to the bill. On behalf of the licensing board's executive directors, we also have a few language changes. We shared those previously with the sponsor and legislative staff. None of these alter the intent or the outcome of the bill. There's some clarification and definitions that some of the boards have raised. The Healthcare Workforce Institute's happy to work with the committee, the sponsors, the boards, and others addressing those amendments. Appreciate the opportunity to speak this morning.
Thank you. There are a lot of different modalities of delivering healthcare, and and I looked at your list in section two. We also have a board of radiological technology. We have a board of psychologists. We have board of optometry. We have a board of naturopaths, and we have a board of chiropractors. How did the health fund board come to the decision to use just these boards that we have that are affected with or that deal with health care?
Well, this is the start of a process. We had an open invitation for anyone to join the process. These were the boards that joined us. There are also other health practitioners who don't have a board. I mean, there's other practitioners who aren't licensed. That's another issue that I think we need to face down the line. The scope of this is intended to be comprehensive, but we have to start, as we said, with focusing on where we know some of the shortages are. Some of the boards are much more able to start this process, have some resources. They clearly need some additional help, but some boards have one staff person, and they're going to build on what other boards are able to produce over time. So that's our goal. We'll have to address all the other boards as well as other non-licensed professionals as well as we move this process forward.
All right. Yes, Senator Bates.
Madam Chair, thank you. Just a couple quick questions if I could. First off, I know there's amendments coming. I haven't seen them, so I don't know what they look like when I read through this last night. One part that did jump out at me a little bit was on page 2 of the printed bill we have, line 8, the information you'll be asking for. One is sort of a broad question. It's personal information. It struck me as kind of a strange thing, you know. And I don't expect you to know every little word of this right now, but obviously some personal information would be very helpful to know about what's happening to your workforce. I mean, you could ask physicians, how's your 401k doing, you know? Are you going to be working for the next 10 years, or are you all through, you know?
401k.
Yeah, and since so many of them are now back to work, they quit last summer, you know. But you can't ask that kind of information. But what I would like something a little more specific on this. The nursing board obviously must ask for information of that nature. This is going to be done by rule, but sometimes rule gets a little strange.
Yeah.
And we've seen this happen before. Senate Bill 10, which you don't know about, got pretty strange. And I just wondered what your intent here was, and to get on the record what your intent was, and maybe even define that a little more closely for us.
Senator Loomis Anderson and Senator Bates, I'll speak, and then John may have some additional thoughts, but I think the difficulty is that some providers, I know physicians sometimes use their home address as their mailing address for the board for reasons of convenience, or they have several offices or whatever. So sometimes we do need to get some of that information to be able to track them down and get the information. So in our current survey world of trying to do this, so I think that the intent was not to be, and I think this came up in House Bill 2118, has some language also about what's if you collect information, then is it publicly able to go out to others? And there was some requests from one board about some marketers wanting to get access to that information. So we would want to ensure that the information is gathered for the purposes of trying to get good aggregated data to tell us about the workforce, but not somehow open up any sort of breach of confidentiality with the licensees themselves.
Madam Chair, may I follow up? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know your intentions are good, and I'm not worried about confidentiality. Obviously, you got that covered. It's just such a broad statement that when rulemaking comes, it could be interpreted a lot of different ways, and these practitioners, including physicians, are going to be required to give that information to get licensed. And if they write things in there that fire people up, we could have problems. I just would like to see a little tighter definition of that. I know your intentions are good. I know what you're trying to get to. The nursing board obviously has done this.
Well,
we might take some guidance from them about what that should say there.
We had to say whether we were Caucasian or Latino or black. Those are the types of things I'm looking at as personal information, mailing address maybe. Age is personal, that is asked.
That's all required for physicians, but mm-hmm. I just like a little more definition potentially there, Madam Chair.
Yeah, we're talking about if I might clarify, sort of, I think to add to that, the initial application, your birth, gender, race, ethnicity, languages, professional education, date of your first license, on renewal applications, you want to know, are you currently working in Oregon? Are you mm-hmm. working full-time, part-time? What's the address? What's the practice location? What's the setting in which you work? What is the specialty focus? Some question about planning to retire, and what percentage of time you're practicing clinically. I mean, given that we have basically none of that information, we certainly have a long way to go. This is not a comprehensive workforce surveys. We do have other surveys. We anticipate other surveys will continue, such as done EHS and OMA. They'll look at other aspects of the workforce. I think we're experience in other states would tell us that to get the cooperation and buy-in from healthcare workers, we've got a limit and really choose this. When we started this process, we had two or three pages of questions. We're down and shortened that to, I think, to a more reasonable length. We're adding on to an application that already is viewed by some as somewhat cumbersome. We'll work on defining that a little bit better.
Madam Chair, I'll just make a final comment. The other lines are 9 through 13 actually cover all the things you just mentioned. Okay, and that's why A struck me as strange. Okay, I mean, everything else needs to be covered. It's education information, license information, employment information, primary and secondary practice information, and anticipate changes in the practice. And those are the kind of things, that's the information you really want to get to. And it's
date
in there already.
Yeah.
So why the personal information?
Well, the date of birth, it would cover date of birth. And
that's already required for licensure. So.
And not race.
Anyway, enough said. Just kind of, that just strikes me as pretty wide open, and I've seen rules come down that we've thought, where did that come from? And they said, well, it's personal. Say anything we want to there. So, I fully agree with everything else you said.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Like Senate Bill 10.
That's what I mentioned it earlier. It's like Senate Bill 10. The next thing I know, I got, you know, Churchill relatives in Tennessee saying, how come I'm on your form? You know.
Okay.
Okay, Senator Mona Sanderson and members of the committee, my name is Graham Slager, and I'm the administrator of the Employment Department's Workforce and Economic Research Division. I've spoken to several of you before, and I think you know that a lot of Oregon's workforce economic information comes from our division, unemployment rates, employment trends, including employment trends in the healthcare industry, as well as every other industry, and wages, and so on. We're also the ones who develop the employment projections that help young people think about careers and help colleges plan programs of training. And we do some special reports. One that we've just done that I know has been discussed in some other committees is this Training Oregonians for the Right Careers. And one thing in there is a top 20 list of the healthcare occupations that we think should be among the priorities. We've got lists for manufacturing and construction and many other groups. And we're also the ones that, under the Senate Bill 882 from 2005, we have responsibility for Oregon's healthcare workforce needs assessment, which is kind of a periodic assessment of the workforce shortage, which occupations are in shortage, and by how much. So we were not involved in the development of this bill. We weren't involved in the work groups. But when we saw this bill, we just wanted to come and say that the information from this would be very, very helpful to us for some of the reasons that Dr. Moore had mentioned. It's very hard, for example, to get information on self-employment. So if a physician is working for another agency or a private clinic or a hospital, we get great data in terms of the count of physicians. If they're completely self-employed, that becomes very difficult for us. This would be one added source that would kind of fill a gap that we're often accused of, you don't have good information on this, and we acknowledge that. So it would be very helpful. It would also be helpful just projecting demand. Obviously, we look in the healthcare industry at growth, but another big component is retirements and other reasons why people leave the healthcare occupations, maybe not because of retirements, but we still have openings because they left for whatever reason it is. The kind of information that would be gathered here and made available to us would be just excellent. It would help us with the workforce shortages the next time we do a healthcare workforce needs assessment, again, the Senate Bill 882 assessment. And we just see many other examples of the kinds of analysis we could do. The chair mentioned age, gender, of different kinds of occupations. That can become pretty interesting when you're trying to figure out not just are there enough workers today, but will there be enough workers in this occupation 5 or 10 years from now? We also think Senate Bill 457 has some kind of good government or efficiency aspects, because we do a lot of surveys, mostly of businesses. We certainly could try, as has been mentioned, other groups do, of individuals. And if we can get a lot of this information in a very consistent manner when the licenses are applied for, then we wouldn't have to be doing surveys of different individual Oregonians to ask similar questions over and over again. We get the information once, and we leave people alone. So we're not, you know, major players in the development of this bill, but we just wanted to come and say it would have great benefits for Oregon's workforce analysis system, and particularly in this case as it relates to healthcare. So respecting your time, that's all I really wanted to say, and I'll be happy to take questions.
Thank you. Thanks. I think it's extremely important, if we do take out the word personal, we want to make sure we have in there what language they speak. We want to make sure, of course, the race and ethnicity. And maybe we... is this one of those bills that would need amendments regarding the cultural problems that we have? We want to make sure that we address that, and that's why...
Senator Moniz-Anderson, yes, there are some sort of specific, just to make sure that there's an overt awareness that minorities and people of color aspects are considered when collecting the information, analyzing the information, and also making sure that, you know, a better understanding of our workforce to serve those populations by perhaps having that reflected in the population, in the workforce itself. So yes, there would be a few amendments, and I think the word personal information, I see, you know, demographic we use on the first page, probably something similar on that page would mm-hmm. probably fix mm-hmm. that.
And
good pickup.
Thank you. Graham, you raised a question that I had not considered, and that was the flow of information. Having access to aggregated data, I can see, would be very helpful. But I'm concerned, are there provisions in the bill that put appropriate sideboards to the personal information, so that as it comes from the regulatory boards to one collection agency, and then you're dealing with aggregated data rather than personal data? And your comment here, I can understand how it could be a great advantage. I could also understand how it could be of great concern to those who are licensed if they had specific licensing information that flowed beyond the boundaries of the actual regulating board in a way that could be misused. And I don't know where that language resides in here in terms of the propagation of that information.
I can't speak to the language, but I can speak to the intent. And clearly, from day one, that's been a principle that we've espoused to each of the boards, and one that would protect the confidence. The only way we could go about this. I'll try to look for the language. I'm not familiar with the language that we need.
Chair Moniz-Anderson, Senator Morris, I think our experiences, we have often been in situations where we have personal identifiable information and it's aggregated, and we've preserved it and kept it that way, and then allowed, for instance, our hospital discharge database has some very secure, certain elements are allowed to be released to other entities, but certain other elements are not. And so we can look to make sure that kind of language is in here for protection for those purposes.
Thank you. I believe that would be very important.
Yeah.
And Madam Chair, Senator Morris, also, there is a parallel for us in that we get a lot of this kind of demographic information on people that are served by the workforce system, people served by the community colleges. We do a lot of performance measurement on those, and our agency, and I think, you know, many agencies, we do have the security, we have the confidential in statute and in rule. So this is the kind of thing we're very used to dealing with. There may be particular language you'd like to see in this particular bill, to make sure of that. But this would be, in a sense, very much business as usual, certainly for my agency, because we're already getting information very similar to this from colleges, from others, and we're used to dealing with it, and certainly protecting the confidentiality, absolutely.
Senator Cruz?
Yeah, Madam Chair, page 2, lines 20 through 24 of the bill speak to that.
Okay, thank you.
Oh, yeah.
So I think it's covered and it's handled in rule, but it's specific that it may not, that personal identifiable information shall not be, is exempted from disclosure. So
right.
I think it's covered in the bill.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Because of the economic times, I want to talk a little bit about funding. I know this is a ways and means issue, but is the employment department getting federal stimulus dollars that could help us with this? Or, Dr. Smith, is there money that's coming from the feds or opportunities through the federal funding at all?
Madam Chair, I don't know the answer to that. I would have to check with our budget people. I don't believe so. I don't think that any of the funds coming to us, you know, would be suitable for this. Obviously, there's unemployment insurance and some other employment placement funds, but I would have to check with budget folks to give you the answer, and I'll do that.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Biggs.
Looking at this, I'm assuming this information will be available to individual boards about their individual members. And that would be really important information for them to have, and they would like to have this information. And you're going to bring it all together for them and do a lot of the work. Has there been any discussion about the boards? And it would be very small. Most of them have ending balances. They work over a two-year period of time. The boards paying for the $434,000, probably some of it's even available for some federal match because there's Medicaid involved in some of these boards. Is there any discussion with the boards about them paying us a diminished amount of money to cover this? What I'm afraid of is that we're going into a budget cycle for 9/11 in which we may have a prohibition on any new spending, dollar one, gone. And that may occur, may not. And a program like this could easily be supported by these boards. Could be some federal match involved on that basis. And it's important information. We really need this. Has there been a discussion with the boards about this?
Senator Sanderson, we have explored federal funding during the year. We haven't identified a source yet, but we're continuing to work within our own institute and with others to try and explore that, including our own congressional delegation and looking for those dollars. We have had discussions with the board about the capacity that they may have to participate. We haven't identified that capacity as yet. I think there's such a variation in the boards in terms of their resources. Some are absolutely. It was one of the key questions right up front was that this is work that's yet not part of the scope of what they do, and frankly, people were a little intimidated in terms of feeling like they had to go out and had an obligation to follow up on all these questionnaires. And I think the experience in other states shows that that's really not probably as big a problem as we anticipated. You have to fill this out to get your license, so there's a pretty good motivation to get it complete. But there was a fear that if just a question wasn't quite done correctly, there would have to be follow-up on that activity, and that was one of the fears of the boards, that they just didn't have the resources to do that. So we're trying to work with them to see where there's some efficiencies that might be contributed to this effort, but to date, this looks like it's new activity, and it's going to need some support from some new areas.
And different boards have... Well, the salaries vary from those. We certainly in the Board of Nursing, we have the most. We have about 40,000, 45. I'm not sure what this. And then physicians is a little smaller, and dietitians. So, yeah. Okay.
Madam Chair, Section 4 of the bill actually says that these boards will take whatever actions necessary to comply with this bill. So, speaking to Senator Bates' issue about using reserves, I mean, that's going to be an interesting discussion with the board.
There's two parts. There's what they have to do to comply with the bill, The other part is what the general fund money commitment is going to be, if we have it, when they give us the information to process that. And so there's two pieces here.
Right. Well, I'd point out, Madam Chair, Senator Bates, there is no mention of general fund in this bill.
Well, the discussion a few minutes ago, I thought, was $474,000 is what you expected to have as a cost.
Yeah, Senator Cruz and Senator Bates, the governor's recommended budget as part of the health fund board's
right.
$5 million.
Right.
There, this amount of dollars was allocated.
Yeah.
We had had a larger amount we had hoped for, but as things deteriorated, where we could do some credits or helpful, you know, direct some of the resources once we had the data to providers, but we had to ramp that back down to this more minimal amount.
Yeah, I guess, Madam Chair, my point is, according to the language of the bill, which does not mention general fund, it may drive to the point that Senator Bates is making about how fruitful the discussions with the boards could be to do this within existing resources.
I'd agree.
Okay.
All right. Well, we want you to work with our administrator in getting the amendments that we've dealt with, and we would like to pursue this as soon as we get those amendments done. Is there any other further discussion from the committee? Thank you very much for coming, Dr. Moorhead. Thank you for coming. And Dave Fiskum.
Madam Chair, committee members, good morning. For the record, Dave Fiskum here representing Providence Health System. It's important for me to remind you that we are a large system and operate 7 hospitals around the state in urban and rural Oregon, a major health insurance plan, as well as a number of special programs in various parts of the state. I'm here this morning on behalf of Providence to support Senate Bill 457, at least. I'm not prepared to talk about all the conversations you've had in the last few minutes. I've taken good notes. We'll relay these to my client. But I do so today in the form of submitting a letter for the record signed by June Chrisman, who is in charge of human resources for our system and who wishes she could be here this morning to talk to you in person. Save that. I've given you her letter. We worked hard with the Oregon Health Fund Board during the interim on a variety of health care reform issues, expanding and improving health care services. We had people who served on a host of subcommittees. But improving services and access is a top priority for us, one rooted in a sense of mission that Providence has to serve low-income Oregonians. Probably won't be a surprise to you for me to say that we disagree with a number of the proposals from the Health Fund Board, and we'll have debates on those through this session, I'm going to assume. At the same time, we have looked at all of the Health Fund Board bills and are trying to support ones we can. For example, Senate Bill 451, the POLST bill, which I understand you're going to be moving on, perhaps, Madam Chair, at your discretion. We're supportive of that, as well as 457. Assuring a qualified workforce is one of the major issues we face every single day in operating our health system, and I think that is an issue that sometimes gets lost in our debates in this building over funding and expansion and access and new populations to be served under Medicaid. As important as those issues are, having a qualified workforce to do all that's really important in nursing, diagnostic imaging, pharmacy, physical therapy. The future for us will be just as challenging as the present in having a qualified workforce to meet those needs, and we see Senate Bill 457 is providing a very important tool for us. I just want to read to you a couple excerpts from the letter for the record that Ms. Chrisman has sent to you. A healthcare workforce database can provide one coordinated fact source to help ensure the supply of healthcare professionals keeps pace with the demand. The ability to identify current and future shortages in the healthcare workforce is invaluable not only to our industry, she says, but to educators and students. Educational institutions would be able to use this credible aggregate data to make important investments that open or expand enrollment, and it's important to provide more enrollment slots for nurses and other individuals. As much as we have needs, this bill won't provide the professionals, but we'll at least know more about where we are with regard to that. Should emphasize to you that the answer to these questions we face in the workforce area is not one that we just and only turn to you to help with, but for example, Providence has created something you may know about, the Providence Scholars Program, which deals with the nursing shortage. Providence pays 2 years of tuition for qualifying students at the University of Portland pursuing a Bachelor of Science in Nursing degree, and in return, those students agree to work for our health system for 3 years following graduation, and the value of those scholarships is $2 million annually. We are developing other innovative approaches to deal with this, but at the same time, we think the import of 457 is worth your consideration. With all due respect to the points about how to fund it, as well as the possibility that this could be, to use my lingo from my days in state government, absorbed within the resources you already have because of the importance of the task, and I'll leave that to you as you deal with this bill and perhaps send it on to what I hope is consideration with a number of other priorities this session that the health board's advanced to you. So with that, I'd be happy to either answer questions or relay your questions to June Chrisman, who knows more than I do about this subject. Thank you.
Thanks so much for testifying, Mr. Fiskum. I would like to have information on the workforce at Providence and health systems, and I've been hearing rumors that you were laying off nurses, and I just can't quite believe that. But with the economy is affecting workforce all over, so the next time this bill comes up, it would be nice just to have that information, if you could give it to us.
Madam Chair, I'll be happy to do that more specifically than the one comment I'd make in response to your question, which is the economy is hitting all of us. Hospitals around the state are already laying off staff in some to some degree, not everyone, but some of them are. I would tell you, just as a generalization, that Providence Health System today, and I don't have the breakdown, but can get it for you, we have 800 vacancies, which we're holding, which we're freezing, which isn't laying off staff, but it's similar to that because we aren't, in fact, hiring staff that otherwise we think we would need to provide the health care services. So I think the extremity of this state's economic circumstance that you feel in this building and that relates to state programs extends to the private sector and, in fact, extends to hospitals and hospital systems today. The Hospital Association has prepared a detailed summary of the extremity of the circumstances faced by our industry and a number of our 60 hospitals around the state, meaning our industry's 60. So I'll be happy to get you a breakdown of our situation, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions? All right, thank you. I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 457, and we're adjourned.